I'd like you to hear a few excerpts from the series of interviews with leaders, activists, and attendees we conducted around the 2020 Democratic National Convention.
The Poor People's Campaign has been incredibly effective in raising awareness, ably led by the Reverend William Barber III and the Reverend Liz Theo Harris. The campaign is making itself heard at the Democratic National Convention, and I am very grateful to have with me right now Liz Theo Harris.
I don't think there was at all sufficient conversation about the reality that half of the U.S. population was facing before COVID-19, let alone this many months into the worst public health crisis that this country has seen in a century. And as we enter, you know, indeed what looks like it's going to be a Great Depression, the issues of living wages, of universal single-payer health care, of housing programs, as well as a moratorium on evictions and foreclosures, the issues that are impacting immigrants in terms of detention, the level of voter suppression. I mean, these issues that are really life and death issues, right? I mean, what we've seen in the United States over the past 5 months is trillions going to bail out the billionaires, the wealthy, the corporations. We've seen actually billionaire wealth increase by hundreds of billions of dollars, right? At the same time that we've seen really unprecedented homelessness or the threat of homelessness, unprecedented job loss and unemployment, unprecedented numbers of people losing their health insurance in a public health crisis, right? And so these are the issues that should be front and center in the convention this week, in this national election. And that's because these are the issues that are impacting Americans. And we need to be doing better than what folks are doing right now.
If there is one lesson that you've learned in organizing and amplifying the issue of poverty and empowering people who are always marginalized because of their economic status, what would that lesson be?
Well, we released a study last week, the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival did. And it shows that poor and low-income people hold in their hands the key to shifting the entire political landscape of the United States. That if in very small numbers, poor and low-income people who are eligible to vote can indeed vote and change the result of elections, right? In the 2016 election, if poor and low-income people had voted at the same level that higher-income voters did, it would have completely changed the electoral map. In a state like Michigan, only 1% of eligible non-voters who are poor and low-income need to vote in this coming election to meet the margin of error, you know, and the margin of victory in that state. And there's 15 other states that basically less than 20% of people. So to us, what you see is that poor and low-income people are a deeply powerful group. Powerful group of even voters in this country. And yet our political parties are putting our issues to the background. But when folks come forward with policies, with bold and visionary platforms, things like universal single-payer healthcare, things like, you know, strong, guaranteed and adequate income programs and a strong safety net, when we talk about, you know, a living wage and housing rights and immigrant rights, that these are the things that can enliven and enlarge the electorate and can actually, you know, change life for the better for everybody.
Most Americans don't even know it, but the Democratic Party recognizes a virtual 51st state. It's called Democrats Abroad and encompasses eligible U.S. voters around the globe. Anja Leonhard is active in Democrats Abroad, Saxony in Germany. How big is the membership of Democrats Abroad?
It's 200K, but the number we like to focus on is actually the 6 million Americans in living abroad who are eligible to vote. So while only 200K of those are registered with Democrats Abroad, 6 million are eligible to vote in the United States.
How many delegates are assigned to this group?
So we have 24 delegates. We have 13 pledged delegates. So those are delegates pledged to a candidate. We have 4 pledged to Vice President Biden and 9 pledged to Senator Bernie Sanders, who won our primary with about 60% of the vote. And the other delegates are either campaign appointed delegates for special committees or automatic delegates who are members of the DNC, mm-hmm. who each have half a vote. So we have 8 DNC members with half a vote each.
So you are a pledged delegate. What's that mean?
So I'm a pledged delegate, which means that I ran to represent a specific candidate at the convention. So I ran to represent the Sanders campaign at the convention. And that basically means that I'm pledged to vote for him during the convention and also to represent your state. So in this case, Democrats Abroad, the Democrats Abroad platform, and generally the voters of Democrats Abroad who voted for my particular candidate.
Is that about challenging the Biden-Harris ticket or more about making sure the most progressive platform possible comes out of the convention?
I would say it's about making sure that we amplify progressive voices. What's particularly important to me is to emphasize that progressive views are still represented by this party. It's not inherently about challenging the Biden-Harris ticket. Many progressives are mobilizing behind Biden-Harris. I mean, Senator Sanders' speech last night, he was very clear about our need to unify as a party. But I think we always have to differentiate between unity and having the same opinion. I think it's really great that our party is so diverse, that it represents so many different perspectives and interests. And I think that we honor this diversity by having conversations, having discussions about things that are important to us.
Dr. J. Michelson is an author, attorney, and activist who brings wisdom and insight to his writing for The Daily Beast and elsewhere. Do you watch all of it straight through? Do you talk back to what's going on the television? How do you watch it?
I don't watch all of it straight through. I do sort of, they tend to save the best for last. So I tend to tune in later. Although I was hoping to actually write an article about Sally Yates's speech, but there wasn't really enough there to write on. Last night I started watching early. Fortunately for me, it's well after my daughter's bedtime, so it's easy to do. But I don't see it as a civic responsibility. I see it much more. I'm curious. I see it as a journalist. I'm interested to see it, what they're doing and how they're doing it. But for myself personally, I think it's like, do you go to services at your church or synagogue? If it's not working for you and you're not getting anything out of it, I don't know. I'm not one who has a sense that there's really that obligation. But even if you know the liturgy by heart, it can still feel good to be reminded of that in a congregational setting. And that's how I feel about the convention. It's not like anybody's telling me anything I don't already know in their convention speeches. But, watching, Michelle Obama's speech brought tears to my eyes. And, I'm a jaded rabbi journalist. I'm a cynical person. I don't get moved to tears easily. And that speech was just so beautiful and so poignant and heartbreaking, when you think about how our presidential discourse has degraded in these last few years. Even Trump's idiotic responses to her on Twitter were completely to type, and you just put those two side by side. There are times, I think for me, that what I wanted to share is there's a lot of anxiety that I still feel about this election. I think a lot of folks on the liberal and further left sides are looking at Biden having like a 12-point lead and feeling pretty good. That is mistaken. If you actually go state by state in the swing states, he's up, but he's barely up. He should be walking away with Pennsylvania, for example, and he's up like a couple of points. That's really scary. there are reasons to feel good about it. There are way fewer undecided voters this time, and maybe undercounted voters may actually help the Democrats this time, whereas last time they helped the Republicans. There's reasons to feel okay, but the complacency that I've seen on some, from some folks reminds me of 2016, where folks were sure that Hillary Clinton was going to beat this clown, and obviously, and you know, we saw how that went. So I have to admit, I find this period to be really anxiety-making, especially since we haven't even seen really the negative advertising that Trump's $1 billion of fundraising are going to buy. So that's going to be unleashed on this country. We're going to think that all Joe Biden ever did was plagiarize a speech and you know, and do something bad in the Ukraine. And so I'm nervous.
The Right Reverend Marianne Budde is the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, D.C. You spoke out boldly about the St. John's Bible photo op incident. Why was that so important to you? And I am going to be presumptuous and say, if anybody knows anything about the prophetic part of Christianity, they know it. But I want to hear you say it as well.
Well, yeah, and I'm not sure that everyone does. It's not a part of necessarily a part of the Christian tradition that is one we lean into all the time. But it is, I think, an important one. Very briefly, I felt that in walking across and standing in front of St. John's Church with a Bible, having, you know, the context is very important, having stated in the Rose Garden the president's intention to use military force against protesting Americans, and then clearing the park with forcible means to to walk across the park. So that's very important. I felt that the president was assuming a spiritual mantle of authority for his actions, and indeed his entire presidency, that I felt was wildly inappropriate, first of all, and didn't belong to him. And as the nearest, I had legitimacy. It wasn't as if he was stepping onto a religious terrain for which I had no authority. And so I thought it was mine to say that we separated ourselves from that action. And also to say, had the president... because we invite civic leaders into spiritual spaces all the time, had the president used that a moment to offer a word of condolence, to read from the Bible, to try to bring some calm to at a moment when the country was, it was a very tense and stressed moment, and all kinds of things were happening that were very frightening. If he had used that moment, we would have gladly shared the spiritual space with him in that way. But that was not his purpose, and that was why I spoke the way I did.
What should people be listening for in the remaining hours of the Democratic National Convention? What are you listening for?
Well, and I would say the same thing for the Republican convention, which is coming shortly. I would listen for the leadership that has a grounded commitment to the well-being of the majority of all American all Americans, and also has the maturity and the strength of conviction and the ability to bring disparate and arguably polarized people together toward objectives of common good. And the pandemic has demonstrated that this is not a aspirational exercise. This is essential to our survival, and that we've been given a sobering test case that demonstrates our interdependence upon one another. That in fact the disparities we have allowed to grow in our country have devastating consequences for everybody, not merely those that the majority society has deemed disposable, and that there's a reckoning. And so I'm listening for the leadership and the posture that would allow more people to participate in the healing and the reconciling, the reckoning, and the moving forward of our country.
Suhas Shukla, Executive Director of Hindu American Foundation. How significant is this aspect of Kamala Harris's identity for average Hindu Americans?
That's a loaded question. Well, first and foremost, I have to just say that bottom line, it's historic. You know, just on August 15th, which is India's Independence Day, when it became the modern nation state that we know of today and was finally released of colonial rule. August 15th, there was a special address by the Biden campaign to the Indian American community. And one of the things that Vice President Biden said really hit me, even though I had seen all the news about Kamala Harris having been selected as the vice presidential nominee, that the Indian American community is seeing for the first time the first Indian American vice presidential nominee. And it had not struck me, because this Indian American identity is not one that Kamala Harris has actually very publicly acknowledged. You know, mm-hmm. She very much talks about her experience as a Black woman, which is the way that she identifies. So I was, you know, first of all, even though I knew, it was a whole entire different thing to hear it said that way. And I think that many people in the Indian American community, as well as the Hindu American community, are looking forward to maybe more acknowledgement and stories and anecdotes of her upbringing and how her Indian identity and the Hindu heritage that she was exposed to on her mother's side of the family informs how she views the world, how she's going to approach the issues. I think that there are, you know, that those are the types of things that people are going to be looking for. But that's not going to be the single most factor that someone's going to vote.
How would you expect someone who had been raised with Hindu values, what would that do for that person's, and how that would influence that person as a national political leader?
That's a very good question. I think some of the fundamentals of the Hindu tradition are, one, that it's a pluralistic tradition. And when you have pluralism as a core value, you are comfortable with multiple paths, which means that you are inherently going to be encouraged to be a seeker. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, I think it's a way of seeing the world as it is, with its complexities. You don't see things as black and white. There's not just one answer. There might be multiple answers, and especially given the critical issues that our nation is facing and the globe is facing, I think that sort of approach of looking at all possible avenues and seeking truth in them, knowing full well that there might be bits of truth in all these different paths, and there might be paths that don't necessarily lead to constructive solutions, is something that, if that was modeled for her, it would be a valuable asset.
Sarah Levin is very busy this week working with Secular Democrats of America as well as with the DNC Interfaith Council. Make America Constitutional Again, Religious Freedom on the Ballot. That's a great name. Now tell us what it is and what do we need to know about it?
Sure. Well, it's a question of what it was, because it was yesterday as we're filming, but luckily it is online, so folks can watch it on YouTube, on Facebook, and today I'll be uploading it to the SecularDems.org website. It was the inaugural event of Secular Democrats of America as a partner organization of the DNC, and it was really a convening of secular Democrats, both delegates and DNC members who were tuning into the convention, but really Democrats and progressives across the country, to talk about what's on the ballot this year, about religious freedom, separation of church and state, all of the issues that are taking place, not just at the federal level, but also at the state level. It was really exciting to have not just two members of Congress on a panel to discuss these issues, but also two state lawmakers from Arizona and Florida. So we had Congressman Raskin and Congressman Huffman, who are the co-chairs of the Congressional Freethought Caucus, which works to advance science-based policy, promote separation of church and state, but also champions the rights of non-theists, atheists, agnostics, and so on. And Representative Salmon, Athena Salmon of Arizona, and Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith of Florida really brought the state perspective of what's going on in terms of religious freedom in their states, whether it be over $1 billion of vouchers going to private religious schools that are allowed to discriminate on the basis of religion in Arizona. There are a number of issues that Representative Salmon spoke about, and it was really a conversation about what's going on kind of at all levels of government that we need to be concerned about as Democrats. What do we envision a better version of ourselves when we think about religious freedom moving forward, and what is on the ballot this year in November? What do we need to be thinking about as voters who care deeply about these issues, as activists who care deeply about these issues, and really drawing a contrast between the Christian nationalist agenda that privileges religion over non-religion and specific religious beliefs over other religious beliefs under this administration, but also across the country at the state and local level, and what do we need to do to rectify that and restore true religious freedom?
I have to ask you this question because I thought about it immediately, knowing that we were going to talk at some point. What did you think of the opening prayer for the first night? And did you all talk about that yesterday?
You know, there were certainly folks who emailed me questions about that who were not particularly happy. I do think that it's important to note that this is the first time that humanists and atheists have been included on this level at the Democratic Convention. So on the one hand, I can absolutely say this is the most inclusive Democratic convention in history. I'm going to be very shortly here joining the second set of programming for the DNC Interfaith Council, which is going to feature prominently a number of humanists, as well as Congressman Huffman, who is a humanist but also openly identifies as a non-theist. But, you know, this is the first go, right? You know, there are did I feel that every single aspect of the convention is, you know, something that was as inclusive as it could have been? No. I'm sure I'm not the only Democrat who has some criticisms about the convention from a variety of perspectives. But I do feel that while, you know, I much would have preferred the opening prayer to not be so sectarian, or to perhaps include multiple perspectives, including a humanist perspective. I do think that the DNC has taken major steps in the right direction of including the non-religious. And I think that just needs to be a continued conversation. And it's I think it's only going to get better from here, now that the non-religious and humanists have a seat at the table.